This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Pakistan is seen through American eyes as unstable, violent, the place that harbored Osama bin Laden and a place where anti-American sentiment runs high. It's also a place with a long simmering distrust of its neighbor India and a place that's been propped up by U.S. military spending, both on government forces and on the same insurgents who now cause chaos there. Hussein Haqqani is the former Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. and a Boston University professor whose new book is called Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. In it, he gives a more nuanced perspective to the relationship between the countries, something that may finally be improving with the reduction in U.S. drone strikes against suspected terrorists there. I spoke with him earlier this week during his trip to Connecticut that took him to Central Connecticut State University and to the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. Hussein Haqqani, welcome to Where We Live.
It's a pleasure being here.
Maybe you can, first of all, lay out the current status as you see them of U.S.-Pakistan relations.
Pakistan and the United States have had a difficult relationship. They continue to have a difficult relationship. Both sides want to continue the engagement, so there have been some high-level contacts. Prime Minister Sharif was in Washington, D.C. not long ago, met with President Obama. The Pakistani National Security Advisor was there barely 2 weeks ago. But the fundamentals of the relationship remain tricky.
When you say they remain tricky, what are the main reasons why they remain tricky?
Well, Pakistan looks upon India as its existential threat. It has used American weapons against India in three wars. It continues to worry about India having influence in Afghanistan when the Americans leave. Pakistan's entire worldview, shaped by its military, is all India-centric. America doesn't look at that region that way. America's biggest concern is terrorism, especially terrorism, which has support within Pakistan. Pakistan's role in Afghanistan, insofar as it supports the Taliban, is not something the United States likes. And American concerns are, will Pakistan deal with terrorism or will it support the Taliban again in Afghanistan? And then, of course, there is the concern about Pakistan's nukes. And America is certainly not going to look upon India as its enemy.
I think it's very important for our listeners to hear what you're saying, because we so often in America look at everything through the American lens. And if the American problem is terrorism, and terrorism is coming from, say, Afghanistan, and Pakistan is the neighbor, maybe harboring terrorists who might threaten the United States, that does seem to be all we care about. This Pakistan-India relationship that's so very important that you laid out there is the existential threat. Talk a bit more about that. Talk about the relationship right now between Pakistan and India, maybe that goes back to the birth of the nation of Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan, as you know, was carved out of India in 1947. The Muslim majority parts became Pakistan. The unfortunate part was that Pakistan got a bigger share of the British Indian Army than it did of British India's resources. So Pakistan got only 17% of the revenue sources and 33% of the army. Now, if I was in charge, I wasn't even born then, but if I was in charge, I would have said, can we afford such a large army that the British could afford for the Second World War, but we are just a new poor country starting out? And I would have trimmed the military. Instead, the Pakistani leaders of the time decided that they're going to keep the military, but what they will do is they're going to try and pretend to be America's allies in the Cold War and get the Americans to pay for the military. What that has done is that Pakistan's antagonism with India has lasted for six decades, because Pakistan's military has continued to be refurbished by the Americans every few years on the assumption that the Pakistanis will either fight communism or terrorism, only to be disappointed. Washington's always ended up being disappointed. At the same time, the public opinion in Pakistan has been shaped in a way in which people look upon India as an existential threat. Now, you and I both know that in international relations, there are no permanent enemies. There are only permanent interests. And Pakistan's real interest should be feeding its population, educating it, and becoming a functional trading nation. The India-Pakistan relationship remains tense. Every few years, they talk about opening trade and doing more tourism, etc. But essentially, if you look upon somebody as an existential threat and you say to yourself that they will always be our enemy, then it's very difficult. And Pakistan's economy continues to suffer. Pakistan invests more in its military and its nuclear weapons capability than it does in its education. So half the population remains illiterate. In 1947, what is today India had a literacy rate of 18%, and what is today Pakistan had a literacy rate of 16%, only a 2% difference. Today, India's literacy rate is 75%, Pakistan's is 55%. The 2% difference has become a 20% difference. And 42% of school-going age children in Pakistan, children between the ages of 5 and 15, do not go to any kind of school.
And India is seen as a growing player in the global economy. India is seen as a place in which U.S. jobs are outsourced to. Pakistan is seen from America as none of those things.
Exactly. And Pakistanis, like myself, are very worried. Look, I'm a Pakistani. I'm concerned about Pakistan. I represented Pakistan in the United States at the time when bin Laden was found in Pakistan. I kept warning my government, telling my government that, look, this obsession with India is not doing us any good. And if we want to gain some benefits from friendship and partnership with America, they should be in the areas of acquiring new technologies, improving our agriculture, learning things which Americans are good at. But unfortunately, over the last 66 years, although Pakistan has been America's ally, it's Pakistan that has been under military dictatorship for more than half its life, while India, which was not a formal American ally, has been a consistent democracy. At the same time, for example, India has diversified its economy, tried to educate its people. Exports constitute 26% of India's GDP. They are only 10% of Pakistan's GDP. So a militarist obsession has undermined the potential for Pakistan's growth. The fact that the entire sort of a policy structure is controlled by a militarist outlook, all we end up having are militants all over.
Well, then let's talk about that outlook. When you say that Pakistan for now decades has seen itself as a warrior nation, who within Pakistan sees that? Is it these isolated jihadi groups that have an outside influence? Is it military leaders who have been part of the government for so many years? Is it the people of Pakistan themselves? Who sees themselves in Pakistan as a military country?
When you ask the question, who sees it, here's how it happens usually in any country.
Yes.
One group sees something, and then it persuades others. And if it's the controlling group, then it's able to convince people more, especially by creating an educational system that gravitates towards that. So originally, it was the Pakistani military. They needed to convince America and the West that Pakistan had the best warriors in the region. In my book, Magnificent Delusions, there's a very interesting episode about how Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under President Eisenhower, was convinced that the only people who will fight the communists in the south of Asia are going to be Pakistanis. He didn't know much about Pakistan. He thought the Pakistanis were Gurkhas, which they were not. Gurkhas are from Nepal. And because of his belief, he just kept investing in Pakistan's military, thinking one day I will be able to deploy some of these troops in wars in Vietnam or Korea or wherever. None of that ever happened. So the military was the original sort of guilty party in thinking of Pakistan or presenting Pakistan as a warrior state. But under military rule, Pakistan's school curriculum was revamped in a way in which the same ideas were transmitted to successive generations in schools. So even today in a primary school in Pakistan, the kids who do go to school get to learn things about how Pakistan is the inheritor of the warriors that conquered India, instead of thinking of themselves as a nation of many people, farmers, industrious artisans, the cultural diversity of Pakistan.
Doctors who would stay in Pakistan and work as opposed to come to America to make their lives.
And even if the doctors came to America, they would be involved in research that would then benefit all of humanity, which is not what is always the case. It's only about sort of making money here and living a comfortable life here and not being there. And so basically what we now have is a national mindset in Pakistan that is predisposed towards thinking of Pakistan only in terms of Islam and and the Islamic religion, instead of even considering the non-Muslims who live in that country as equal citizens of the country. Second, there's a tendency to look upon India very negatively and violently. And thirdly, there's also a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-Americanism. which now has reached its peak. Recent opinion polls show that 83% of Pakistanis have a negative opinion of the United States. The vice chancellor of Pakistan's largest university, Punjab University, who's a physicist, by the way, he's a PhD in physics from the West, even got a Fulbright to research in America at one point. He has written a book recently claiming that 9/11 was actually a CIA operation, primarily to justify American invasion of Muslim lands. But more important, he says something that a normally well-educated person should not even conceive of. He says that America and Britain are controlled by a cabal of bankers, which, as you know, is a term straight out of Mein Kampf, who use microchips put into the heads of people like myself, who are pro-Western, to control them. Now, if you were a normal physicist, it's something that is empirically unprovable. I mean, I volunteered at one point. I said, hey, you know, open my brain and take out the microchip if you can find it. It just isn't there.
Yes.
So you have these conspiracy theories that have become very mainstream in Pakistan. And that has been partly because of the long influence of the military, which used militants and the jihadi militants. Now, the jihadi militants have become a nuisance for Pakistan, and the military recognizes that. But their problem is how to turn off the tap.
When you talk about this internal idea that has been brewing in Pakistan for some time, that is this militarist idea that's fueled all the things that you just said, including crazy conspiracy theories, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the things that the United States over the course of certainly the last several years have been doing that many of us in the U.S. press see as maybe reasons for this growing unrest. The fact is that the drone strikes that continue in various parts of Pakistan to root out Islamist militants are seen by people in Pakistan as invading their sovereign territory, as being something in which an ally of Pakistan is actually striking out against their ally. How much of an impact do you believe that these drone strikes and this ongoing systemic attempt to weed out militants in Pakistan, how do you think that that has influenced public opinion there?
Well, first of all, you must remember that those in Pakistan who are against the militants, even they don't look upon America favorably because they think America was partly responsible for creating the militants in the first place. The Islamist militants were seen as a counter force for Soviet and communist influence. So on the one hand, the jihad started in the name of fighting communism.
With the U.S. dollars,
with
the U.S.
dollars
and
Saudi, yes, and Saudi Arabia matching those dollars and huge amounts of money. So most of these jihadi groups have their roots there. And the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, as it's called, the ISI, which now is seen very negatively in the United States. At one time, it was America's darling, the CIA's darling. So there's that part of the problem. Then you come to fighting terrorism. And again, the better way to fight terrorism may have been to promote democracy in Pakistan. We now have had two successive civilian governments, Mr. Sharif's and then previously Mr. Zardari's. But before that, we had General Musharraf for 10 years. And again, he received far more military and economic assistance than any of the civilian governments have. So the same institution that was actually supporting the militants ended up being bolstered. And last but not least, the instrument that is being used for reaching militants who cannot be reached otherwise, especially by Pakistani forces, is the unarmed drone. I personally feel that Americans have a point when they say, hey, what do we do? You won't act against these people. They're living in your country. It's like somebody not cleaning up their own backyard and that backyard becoming a nuisance for the whole neighborhood. So what we are doing is we are using this instrument, although I have a lot of ethical problems with the use of the drone, because in a war, a soldier can see another soldier and can demand his surrender, and the person can surrender. Here, this is assassination. Like, the order's been given. The man has no choice. He can't raise his hands and say, okay, I want to be a prisoner of war. So you're actually just assassinating people. But in case of Pakistan, there would be less deployment of drones if Pakistan's own military was acting against the militants in these areas. So it's a catch-22 for America. You use the drones, you become unpopular. But if you don't use them, then all these Al-Qaeda figures who have assembled in Pakistan go about their business plotting terrorism without being checked by the local force. And so the solution would be a Pakistani initiative to root out terrorism. If Pakistan took the lead and decided, you know what, enough of this, whatever our reasons, we got into this, but it was a mistake, it's now coming back to bite us. There have been more terrorist attacks inside Pakistan resulting in deaths of Pakistanis than there have been in the United States recently. Why the heck are we involved in this business? And then start shutting down the jihadi operations.
But isn't the worry amongst military leaders in Pakistan that if indeed they do that, they're turning so much against public sentiment? Just like the idea of U.S. troops being able to go in and get Osama bin Laden out of Pakistan. Some, I'm sure, in that country said, why is the United States able to do this? Why are you allowing this to happen?
Sure.
Pakistan's government probably is looking at it saying, it's not very popular to root out terrorists in our country on behalf of the United States right now.
Certainly not. And that's why Pakistan's government's position should be that we need to root out terrorists for Pakistan's sake.
Not for the U.S.,
but do it for ourselves. Look, the terrorists have attacked mosques in Pakistan. The terrorists have a very narrow vision of what it means to be Muslim. So they have attacked Shia Muslims. They've attacked a sect called the Ahmadiyyas, who do not believe in jihad. They have attacked Pakistani Christians. They have attacked Pakistani Hindus. And then among Sunnis, they have attacked those Sunnis who are, shall we say, low church, who are not into, you know. And so there's a kind of a religious internecine fighting going on in Pakistan, which these jihadis are part of. Look, individuals can be pious. Societies can be religious. But a state has to be secular by definition. Otherwise, you just cannot keep a diverse population together. Pakistan is not a homogeneous nation. It was based on a notion of majority of Muslims constituting a country. But look, Pakistan lost its eastern wing, which became Bangladesh in 1971, in a huge civil war. Pakistan has several ethnic groups. Pakistan needs to embrace its pluralism and be a pluralist democratic state that it goes about the business that other nations go about. That cannot happen if most of the resources of the country go to one institution, which is the military, which then shapes the nation's worldview. You know, when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So when you have the military as a dominant institution, has a military, the military has an economic presence, it runs businesses, it runs educational institutions, it has a say in the shaping of curricula, and it does not allow open debate. For example, people like me, even though I've served as Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S., we are described as traitors by some people in Pakistan for arguing that maybe Pakistan needs to redefine its national interest. Mm-hmm. It's not in Pakistan's interest to be isolated from the world. Pakistan could benefit from greater engagement with America, but that engagement has to be non-military. It has to be trade. It has to be educational exchange. It has to be tourism.
Coming up, more conversation with Hussein Haqqani, former Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., about his new book, Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. We'll also find out about how some Pakistani Americans in Connecticut view this relationship. That's coming up, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with Hussein Haqqani, former Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., about his book, Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. He'd mentioned the idea of the U.S. fostering democracy in Pakistan, something that the U.S. has had a spotty record doing in that region. I asked him what this would look like in his country.
Well, I think the most important thing in case of Pakistan would be that the Americans have to stop looking at the military and the intelligence service as independent entities. They have to say, okay, you've had an election, you have an elected government. Now the elected government should speak on behalf of Pakistan with us. The Americans have traditionally always gone to our intelligence service and our military and cut deals. For example, the drones. No civilian government signed an agreement with the Americans on allowing them to conduct drone strikes. This was something that was agreed upon between General Musharraf, who was seen as a usurper by most civilian Democrats in Pakistan. Look, my view is slightly different about America's role in the world. I don't think the world is a problem for America to solve. It's a reality for Americans to understand. What I see as a flaw in American policy often is the American rush to try and figure out what can we do. My view is, let us foster democracy, and you stop encouraging the forces of dictatorship and the military. And if you stop doing that, we'll somehow manage on our own. And Pakistan needs not to be dependent on the United States. Look, there have been three consequences of America's mismatched alliance with Pakistan. First, of course, Pakistan has been encouraged to think of itself as a military rival to India, and it has prolonged the India-Pakistan conflict. Pakistan would not have been able to militarily compete with India if it hadn't become an American ally on false pretenses. Second is, Pakistan has become very dependent on the United States. And dependence always brings anger as well. You know, you want to control the relationship rather than let somebody else control it. So Pakistan, on the one hand, has benefited from $40 billion in American assistance since 1950, which is a very large amount. Mm-hmm. But on the other, there is resentment against Americans telling Pakistanis what to do. So dependence is not good for Pakistan. It's not good for the United States. The third thing that has happened is that Pakistan, there has been a disincentive for reformers in Pakistan in terms of reforming Pakistan internally. Because if Americans are, if Uncle Sam will pick up the bill every few years for the economy, et cetera, for the military, why should Pakistan have an internal debate about how to reform itself, how to lessen its military burden, how to increase its tax collection, how to invest more in education and healthcare rather than in building nuclear weapons? That debate has been postponed. So I personally, in my book, the title, Magnificent Delusions, basically talks about the delusions of both sides. Pakistan's delusion that with American assistance it can continue to pursue a course of forever war with India, and the American delusion that just by giving assistance to Pakistan's military, it will somehow make Pakistan secure and Pakistanis allies of America. Both sides have failed in their delusions. It's time, actually, to look at new options.
We just have two minutes left. And I want to ask you about one big change that may or may not be coming. As the United States gets ready to fully withdraw from Afghanistan, neighboring Pakistan, does this change anything? Does the U.S. role in Afghanistan changing in that part of the world, does it change anything with its Pakistan relationship, you think?
My fear is that Pakistan will try, of course, to create a government in Afghanistan that it prefers. It may end up having to support the Taliban again, partly because that's the only force in Afghanistan that still looks to Pakistan. There are long-term cultural and ethnic issues involved here. And if Pakistan does not understand the need, or Pakistan's leaders do not understand the need to eliminate terrorism right away, then the safe haven of Al-Qaeda and its associated groups in the northwest of Pakistan and in parts of Afghanistan will become a major nuisance, drawing the Americans back into that region a few years down the road. So American withdrawal, there's only one thing worse than engagement that is poorly planned, and that is withdrawal that is poorly planned. So Americans should actually think about post-withdrawal circumstances, make sure that their original objective in going to Afghanistan, which was to eliminate terrorism or at least break its back, that objective is not lost when they withdraw.
Hussein Haqqani, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Such a pleasure talking to you.
Hussein Haqqani, former Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. His new book is Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. I spoke with him earlier this week during a trip to Connecticut that took him to Central Connecticut State University in New Britain and to the World Affairs Council of Connecticut in Hartford. To get a bit of local perspective on the Pakistan-U.S. relationship, we called Zahir Sharaf. He's president of the Pakistani-American Association of Connecticut. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you for taking me today.
The first thing I'd like to ask you is, what are some of the greatest misconceptions in your mind in the way that the people of the two countries maybe don't understand each other well enough?
Well, $40 billion have been contributed by U.S. since the formation of the country to Pakistan, But most of that has gone into the military aid, and that hasn't helped Pakistan. That money hasn't helped yet. And U.S. needs to encourage Pakistan to look inward, reform its economy and educational system. And there is a big lack of trust between both countries also. But still, there is a room for working on several aspects like counterterrorism, energy, regional stability, and trade and investment. I mean, if you ask any of the Pakistanis, most of the Pakistanis living in Pakistan, they think that U.S. is not their friend. And this is the biggest misconception, although U.S. has given a lot of aid to Pakistan. But since it has gone militarily, so there hasn't been a direct impact on the life of a general person over there. So what I think that if the democracy is strengthened and we help in the areas which I just mentioned, that is going to really help in building our image over there. By our, I mean the U.S. image.
We're talking with Zahir Sharaf, who's president of the Pakistani American Association of Connecticut. I want to bring into our conversation Sohaib Sheikh, who is a web administrator for the Pakistani American Association of Connecticut, who also joins us by phone. Sohaib, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John.
As we talk about this misunderstanding, perhaps you have some thoughts on this as well, this idea that these are two countries that don't fully understand each other, two countries that have been reliant on each other in many military ways, but haven't necessarily formed the types of bonds that the United States has with other places when it comes to trade or cooperation. So, hey, how do you see this relationship? How do you think we could make it better?
Yeah, I think Mr. Zahir Sharaf had it nailed down pretty well. We know there is a lot of cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan on a military and strategic level. However, the common man doesn't see much gains from it. In fact, I would say some of the people are affected adversely because of that. And the best way, I think, going forward is for the U.S. to invest on a grassroots level in Pakistan and help development in the economy and help support the democratic government so that the common man can see the benefits of U.S. involvement, which, unfortunately, they're not seeing now.
One of the things that I spoke with Hussein Haqqani about that I think is very important and something that I think I'd heard from him and that I maybe haven't heard from any other commenters in this region, the U.S. tends to think of Pakistan in terms of its relationship to other countries in the Middle East. It's a border with Afghanistan, say. But to many Pakistanis, the most important relationship is the relationship with the neighboring country of India. India is a country that's seen not only by the U.S., but also by the rest of the world as a growing economic force, as a place that is both exporting materials and exporting expertise, and is also growing quite fast economically there. Pakistan is not seen in the same way. I'll ask you first, Sohaib, and then Zahir, I'd like you to chime in too. What would help make Pakistan more of an economic center for growth the way that we've seen India grow over the course of the last several decades?
Well, again, it goes back to that comment where the U.S. should assist in the local economy and the democratic government and assist in programs that are truly non-military related. And but before the U.S. can do that, the security situation needs to be improved so that there can be good economic stimulus. And once that is done, I think the best thing that the U.S. can do is further fund development programs, invest in the local economy. That's the only way that the economy of Pakistan can grow and it can be at the stature of other developing nations.
But Mr. Sharaf, beyond the U.S. involvement, is there something specifically holding back Pakistan from having the economic growth that, say, India has had internally, something beyond external investment, but something about Pakistan itself that is keeping itself from growing?
The biggest hurdle between Pakistan and India's relation is the issue of Kashmir. You may know that Kashmir is a disputed territory, and that's the biggest issue. If U.S. Can intervene and help both countries in solving that issue, I think that the economic growth will automatically take place in that area. And South Asian, both of these countries can come closer to each other, and which is, again, and they do have a history of thousands of years of living together. and it's only 65 years that they have been separated. So the only way that that area can economically grow, that if the differences can be finished between these two countries.
I'm wondering, Zahir, if you might talk to us a bit about the sense of the Pakistani-American community in Connecticut. Are there still fears within the community of some of the bias that we saw after 9/11, in which a number of people, not only from Pakistan, but from other parts of the Muslim world, even, honestly, other parts of the world, were being targeted because, in some ways, in some Americans' minds, they were linked to terrorism. Is that still something that plagues your community now, many years after that event?
Well, we had seen few incidents after 9/11 here in our state, but now the things have improved a lot. The community has intermingled with the local people, so there are not such misunderstandings now at a bigger level, I should say. In fact, we do have one of the mayors of the Pakistani region also in the town of South Windsor, Mayor Saud Anwar. He is of the Pakistani region now.
And he's someone who's been on our program a number of times talking about issues from that region, and also has a new mayor as well. So, Habib, how about from your perspective, do you think that that there are still gains that the Pakistani community in Connecticut might need to make in terms of the larger community, maybe understanding a bit more about your background, about your religious beliefs, about who you are?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I mean, I think there is still more strides that we can do as a community to help educate other people about who Pakistanis are, what our cultures are, what our values are, and perhaps help them get an idea that's away from the mainstream stereotype that is perpetrated out there. And that is something that we do as a nonprofit organization. That is one of our aims. But yes, there is a lot of room to be made, to be covered, and we hope that it continues to be covered in a few years. And
there's been a lot of news recently about this relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, and hopefully some improvements there. One of the things that has been a stumbling block in this relationship has been the ongoing drone strike program in Pakistan, where U.S. officials are trying to root out terrorists in mountainous regions and have been sending in drones occasionally, which kill civilians and which target people who they believe are tied to terrorism. The U.S. has recently said that they are planning to scale back or stop that drone strike program. How important do you think that has been in the conversation between the two countries and in an understanding? A lot of us in the media think it's been a very big deal, but from the perspective of Pakistani Americans, Sohib, I'll ask you first: how big a deal do you think the drone strike program has been?
Well, I think that is the number one issue that's a sticking point between U.S. and Pakistani relations, and whether it's Pakistanis here or back home or Pakistani Americans, that is the topic of discussion these days when it comes to U.S. and Pakistani relations. So. It has been a big, I think, personally, a detrimental effect, impact on the relationship. And it's a good sign that it is something that is being tuned down or perhaps halted. And that is one of the things that I wanted to point out to your earlier question about what the U.S. can do to improve the relations. Well, that's one of the first things that they can do is seize, limit the drone strikes, which is what the local population has been asking. And that would be another way that they can strengthen the local democracy, is where they can provide these equipment to the local military or local government instead of being operated by the U.S., where it's considered an incursion of Pakistani airspace, if you will, by the common man there.
Zahir, how about you?
Yeah, adding to what Sohib said, that public polls indicate that 83% of the Pakistanis have a negative view of Americans. America, I should say. It's based on what people are told. You know, it's based on a feeling of abandonment by America at different times, and its reaction to being overly dependent also. And in only year 2013, there were 27 drone attacks, and which has made a real negative impact of U.S. in that part of the world. So, and it hasn't proved so far positive. and it hasn't helped either of us. So I think that this policy has to be revised, and these drone strikes, if it has to be done, then it should be done with the Pakistani authorities instead of U.S. going there independently.
A last thing, I think it's an important issue that we haven't really discussed yet, is this idea of immigration and the ability for Pakistanis to come and make a life here in Connecticut in a number of different ways, including working in technology fields. From the standpoint of your organization, what does the U.S. need to do when it comes to improving immigration and the ability of Pakistanis to come here to the U.S.? Sohaib, do you have some thoughts on this?
In regards to immigration, I think the best thing that the U.S. can do is bring the immigration policy for Pakistan at a level that's par or equal to other nations. For example, the general conception with the Pakistani community back home or here is that applying for a work visa or an immigrant visa is much easier from other countries if, let's say, an Indian does it or someone else does it compared to being a Pakistani individual. And, you know, the application processes are long, so I think there's room for improvement in streamlining the process and leveling the playing field, as it were, for Pakistanis compared to everyone else.
Sohaib Sheikh and Zahir Sharaf are both from the Pakistani American Association of Connecticut. They joined me by phone today. Thank you both so much. I truly appreciate your time.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, questions of spirituality are very personal. So would you feel more comfortable answering if you got them on a text from your phone? That's what one UConn study is doing. We'll find out more coming up where we live right after this. In 2012, a Pew Research study showed that a majority of Americans, even those who don't affiliate with any religion, consider themselves to be spiritual. But what exactly does it mean to be spiritual? For researchers trying to look into this, it's hard to get answers to these deep questions. So at UConn, they're trying something new. It uses your cell phone and a few simple questions that you get via text message. Here to talk about Soul Pulse is Bradley Wright. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Connecticut at Storrs. Bradley Wright, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate being on the show.
So first of all, explain what Soul Pulse is.
Well, Soul Pulse is an academic study rooted here in the University of Connecticut. And when people take part of it, they sign up, and then for 14 days, they get two text messages a day about their spiritual lives. And they're brief surveys. They fill them out on their smartphone or their talk and text phone, if possible. And at the end of 14 days, they get a nice report about what's sort of going on in their life.
Very interesting. So I'm going to ask about what some of the questions are, but first, maybe you can give me a bit more of the genesis of this. Why this particular study?
That's a good question. It's a type of research that is just now becoming possible, smartphone technology. It's called online experience sampling methods. And the idea here is that you're sampling people at the moment that they're experiencing something in their real life. So you're not bringing them into the lab to do experiments on. You're not calling them on the phone and asking them about what happened a month ago. You're saying, what's happening now? And this is possible because of cell phone technology. And so we wanted to take advantage of that to study spirituality, because so much of how people experience spirituality is in the moment. It's what's going on right then. And so we wanted to be able to capture that.
Talk a bit more about how people experience spirituality in the moment. It's a very interesting idea, because I think many of us believe that we have some sort of deep-held spiritual beliefs, even if we don't talk about them on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not sure if I think about spirituality in the moment. Maybe that's why this sort of survey is exactly right. Tell me more about that.
Well, a traditional view of spirituality is that it's just an inherent function of the person. You know, so one person will be redheaded and 5'10", another person will be 6'3" and, you know, brunette with dark hair, and it's just the way they are. And there is an element of that with spirituality. You know, some people have this type of religious affiliation or spiritual beliefs or spiritual practices. But in addition, people vary across moments. And so somebody who can be a devout whatever will be more devout sometimes and less devout other times. And in terms of types of spirituality, there's quite a few different ways that people experience spirituality, some rooting it in formal religion, other in sort of religious-esque beliefs that are sort of free-floating, and others that have no reference to religion. They're sort of more of a personal spirituality.
The idea of talking about spirituality is, of course, always hard. I mean, we're told that talking about politics and religion in polite company isn't something that sometimes makes you a whole lot of friends. Do you find that it's difficult for people to honestly say, here are my spiritual beliefs?
Well, I think if I add, when we ask it that way, it probably would be. What we try to do with this survey is just ask very specific questions. For example, the cornerstone question that we're asking is, how much are you experiencing God or whatever you hold as holy at this moment? So that's a little bit more narrow than like a full report of spiritual beliefs. Every once in a while, I'm asked what my spiritual and religious beliefs are, and I can answer, but I'm never fully satisfied with the answer. So I think you're right, that's it's tough to describe something that broad succinctly.
But I like this idea, though, that you're trying to get at what people are actually experiencing now as opposed to what they believe their beliefs are. Or put another way, you know, we may register to vote as Republican or Democrat, but at any given time, we probably believe some things that are quite Democratic and some that are quite Republican. This is really more about asking the question, what do you feel right now? Which I think gets at a different question than, you know, am I Catholic or am I Protestant or am I Muslim?
Exactly. In fact, I'm going to write down how you just described it, and we're going to use it in the future. You're exactly right. We're not getting at what people believe they believe. We're getting at what people experience at that moment. And it does vary across situations. For example, one of the questions we ask is, you know, do you feel, if you're talking to someone, do you feel love toward them at that moment? And that's a very different question than, do you just love people in general? And we find that there's a lot of variation, that, you know, people, whether it's love, joy, peace, gratitude, sort of spiritually related emotions or spiritual experiences, that they vary a lot throughout the day and across days.
Do you worry at all that there is any sort of a disconnect between people's spiritual lives and the technology that you're delivering these questions to them on? It often seems as though our technology, the type that we hold in our hands, puts us distant from many things, including sometimes the people that we're sitting with at dinner. I wonder if there's any worry about a barrier to true spiritual belief when you're, you know, answering a text that you get.
That's a great question. And in fact, we're just appreciating the question. We haven't answered it. I had a discussion a couple months ago with somebody who does qualitative ethnographic research, and we're thinking that the way to answer that is to do a study of how people engage spirituality through technology.
We're talking with Brad Wright. He's an associate professor of sociology, and we're talking about a project called Soul Pulse. It's a way to gauge spirituality using the sorts of technology that we all have, just maybe our iPhone in our hand. Why are these questions so important to you about people's spirituality?
Mm-hmm. I study religion and spirituality as a sociologist, and the great majority of quantitative data on these are along the lines of what kind of, you know, Christian, Muslim, Jew are you? How often do you do something? Sort of what is your trait when it comes to spirituality? So when I put two and two together with a friend and realized we could look at the state of spirituality, I realized that this would open up a whole new type of data that would allow us to test our ideas much more strongly, or at least complement the existing surveys out there. So from a professional perspective, this is a brand new way of approaching important questions about spirituality and religion and society. From a personal perspective, spirituality is something I think a lot about, and I enjoy learning about it, and this is a keen way to do so.
Do you think that we're getting more or less spiritual in America these days?
There's a lot of studies on religious affiliation, but that's not what you asked. Spirituality, this is just my, you know, out of my back pocket opinion, and so it's not rooted in any data, but I would say probably no, we're not less spiritual now. So yes, we're as spiritual as we ever have been. I think what's changing is the form of spirituality.
Mm.
That's just my guess. I'll probably go look it up in some data here and have a better answer in a couple days.
But when you talk about the form, tell me more of what you mean. You're making a distinction here between religion and spirituality, which, mm-hmm. of course, is a real distinction. But maybe even just for our audience, you can talk about that a bit more from your expertise. I mean, what
sure.
is the difference between religion and spirituality to you?
Sociologists often treat religion as an organization or institutional component to spirituality. So if you're religious, you go to church. If you're religious, you go to mosque or to temple, or you're involved in some group, or you have an affiliation with a larger organization. Spirituality is more about somebody's personal beliefs and attitudes and practices. Now, the two are linked. You know, so if you're a practicing Catholic, then you'll probably, you know, say grace, and you'll probably pray at night, and you'll probably have a certain set of beliefs. So the two are linked, but they're not the same thing. So one's more the institutional, organizational aspect of it, and the other is more the personal side.
A last thing for you. It's a very interesting project, but I guess I'm wondering if it has legs beyond the research that you're doing. I've done interviews in the past, and I've even tried out some of these apps that track your life. You know, you tell it how many calories you eat, mm-hmm. or you tell it, for instance, how many miles you've walked, or maybe it even tells you by vibrating in your pocket. Is this the sort of technology or application or even idea that might be more broadly applied even to people who, I don't know, want to download an app for $1.99 and learn more about their spiritual lives?
It is. Not in its current form, though. Right now, it's sort of tricked out as an academic study, and some people find personal benefit from it for their own spirituality, but it's only meant to be a 14-day thing, so it's like a state of the union of your own spirituality. In terms of longer-term tracking, that's something we've gone back and forth on, and we're starting to drum up some demo apps of what they might look like. And that's kind of a tough nut to crack, but I think there's something there, that people care so much about their spirituality that they would want to track it as a way of managing it, just like they would with their calories or their how many miles they ride their bicycle.
I promised I was only going to ask one more question, but I have one more for you, and it just dawned on me. This may be the sort of thing that you learn through a research project like this, but do you have a sense that people of different religious affiliations might be more willing to use a technology like this to answer questions or to explore their own spirituality than others? For instance, is it more likely that a Christian would be happy to answer a text than perhaps a Muslim or a Buddhist? Or is there no, in your mind, differentiation between religious background and how they might interface with a technology like this when it comes to answering tough questions about their own spirituality?
At first blush, I would think that it would be a function of social class and familiarity with technology more than religion. So some people in society are more likely to have a smartphone than others. So young and well-educated. Like in my classes at UConn, they all have smartphones.
Sure.
Except one person last semester, and everyone made fun of him. whereas I think more in terms of age and income status being a predictor of comfort with technology, but that's a good question, something we should be looking out for. And let me just put in a quick plug for this study. If anybody wants to participate in it, it's running right now, and you can find it at soulpulse.org, soulpulse.org. Just go to the website, put in your email address, and we'll take it from there.
And when will you have some findings that you'll be able to tell us about?
Hopefully in about 6 months.
Well, I'll tell you what, I will go on soulpulse.org and I'll sign up. And then maybe in 6 months we can check back and sort of see what you found.
I would love it.
Excellent. Bradley Wright is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to our interns, Skylar Magnoli, Anna Novak, Tess Aronson, Jackie Lopper, and Jane Ashley. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.